I wanted to start off to give our listeners an appreciation of what we are actually facing in terms of the mortality figures that we have for cardiovascular disease and what the projections are over the next 20 years from your observations and research.
Well, you know, again, from 50 years of research in the area of cardiovascular disease risk factors, we have a pretty good understanding now, I would say, of the heavyweights of modifiable risk factor for heart disease. So we know that smoking is quite bad. We know that hypertension is a powerful risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Same thing for diabetes. We know also that disorder in cholesterol transport is another powerful risk factor for heart disease. So I would call those four risk factors, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, and abnormalities in lipid transport. I would call them the, the heavyweights, the traditional modifiable risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So we have our, you know, our smoking cessation campaigns, policies, same thing. Hypertension was not diagnosed poorly treated 30 years ago. Now, obviously, we have we look for hypertension, and when we find it, we try to reduce blood pressure, and lives are saved. Strokes are saved. Same thing for diabetes. When we have now powerful drug to lower cholesterol, and we save lives and we save heart attacks. But those gains, those advances are going to be offset by this huge wave of individuals that are characterized by a constellation of new risk factors that are resulting from their sedentary lifestyle and their unhealthy eating habits. It leads to a form of overweight and obesity, and you and I have had this conversation in the past. And we're not stuck on obesity defined by how much you weigh, but really where the excess fat is located. And for almost 20 years now, my group has repeated over and over and published evidence over the years that it's abdominal fat accumulation, too much fat around the waistline, which is really, really a powerful risk factor for diabetes and heart disease. And now we have overwhelming evidence that it's, and I often use this example, I call it the cholesterol of the 21st century, abdominal obesity. And the problem, I work in a heart institute, and again, we were seeing a lot of hypertensive smokers with hyperlipidemia 30, 40 years ago. Now we see a lot of individuals that are using drugs to lower their cholesterol. They don't smoke. They are on drugs to lower their blood pressure, but they're coming to the heart institute with big waistline, and a lot of them are ending up in the hands of the interventional cardiologist or the heart surgeon. So we have, I would say, the texture, the mosaic of modifiable risk factors has evolved. We have made some progress, but unfortunately, you know, those progress could be offset by this big wave of patients now with big waistline, which is the result of their quote-unquote toxic lifestyle.
What do you believe the public needs to understand with respect to the pathophysiology of increased abdominal girth? What is it in the increased abdominal girth that you think is essential for them to understand so that they can say, okay, now I know why I have to start reducing my weight, or at least reducing my waistline? What should they understand from this whole concept?
Well, the waistline is better than your relative weight. And you know, the most commonly used index of relative weight has been the body mass index, or BMI. It's your weight in kilogram divided by your height in square meter. And with obesity is defined by a BMI equal to above 30 kilogram per meter square, overweight by a BMI of 25 to between 25 and 30 kilogram per meter square. But the problem with the BMI, you know, to describe populations, that's fine. You know, if you look at the United States, the average BMI is going up, and as a consequence, there's a greater proportion of Americans, and incidentally, it's the same in Canada, that are characterized by the expected complications of obesity. But if you are a physician, you could have in your waiting room, let's say 20-25 patients, all with the same BMI. Let's say 29, so they are overweight. 29, all overweight to the same extent, and then you look at their risk factor profile. If BMI was so good, why is it then that you see individuals that are perfectly normal, they have no risk factors, and other equally overweight individuals that have diabetes, heart disease, and risk factors, and so on? So clearly, I'm not saying that we should throw the BMI in the garbage can, but we need to go beyond that. And once you have established whether you're overweight or obese from a BMI standpoint, the next question is, where is my excess fat? If I do have excess fat, if I'm not a hockey player or a football player, where is it located? And it is with the waistline that you're going to figure that out.
So with regards to the waistline, when measuring it, again, how much is too much, and what is actually happening with regards, what are the biochemical processes that go on in the abdominal fat that create the problem?
Okay, so let's assume now that you have measured your waistline. We have some guidelines, recently published guidelines in Canada, depending upon your ethnic group. We have identified some waist circumference values above which you are at increased risk. And I'm not saying you're automatically a high-risk abdominally obese person. Let's say, for instance, if you have a waist circumference of 95 centimeter. But what we suggest is that if you have an elevated waistline, you should see your physician, and then he or she's going to perform additional blood tests. Very, very simple one. Look at the amount of fat in your blood, the total fat, we call that triglyceride. Look at how much good cholesterol you have in your blood, the HDL cholesterol in abdominal obesity, it's reduced. Test whether if you have diabetes or your pre-diabetic, test if you have hypertension. If you have those abnormalities and you have an elevated waistline, it's probably due to the fact that your abdominal cavity, underneath your abdominal wall, you have too much of what we call intra-abdominal or visceral fat. And many studies now have shown that this fat has a very distinct metabolism from the subcutaneous fat that women have underneath the hips and thighs, because the hips and thighs fat of women is really promoting fat accumulation. So let's say a healthy woman with a lot of hip and thigh fat is eating a fatty meal. That fat is going to be preferentially stored. The dietary fat is going to be preferentially stored in those fat depots. So those are quote-unquote protective fat depots. But if you are a middle-aged man with the typical, with very little hip fat,
right,
no fat in the legs, and with this, the typical male would look 5-6 months pregnant, well, the fat is located in the abdominal cavity, and those gentlemen, when they eat a fatty meal, they don't have this, what we call a metabolic sink. So the energy has no place to go. It cannot be stored like those quote-unquote healthy women in subcutaneous fat. So it's going to accumulate in the abdominal cavity, but not only there. It will accumulate in the heart, in the liver, in the pancreas, and that phenomenon, it's called ectopic fat, which means fat accumulated at undesirable sites. It's not normal to accumulate fat in the heart or in your muscle or in your liver. But this is due to the fact that, again, the energy that you consume has no place to go. So abdominal obesity could be a marker of that. So first of all, the expanded fat depot has a very peculiar metabolism. It releases a lot of substances in the blood. It releases fatty acids. It releases adipo hormones that we call adipokines. This fat is loaded with cells that we call macrophages that are a source of inflammation. So you have an expanded inflame, if I may say so, abdominal adipose tissue that is going to disturb your many, many metabolic function in your body. So to explain in very simple, to sum up, too much abdominal fat is bad for two things. First, that fat has a peculiar metabolism, releasing substances that are going to cause damage to your body. But also, it's a sign that fat is not stored at the right place,
Dr. Depre, I wanted to turn now to what is happening to our children. And are we seeing now something akin to the canary in the coal mine, looking at our children with respect to obesity?
Now, I'm going to remove my hat as a university professor, and I made that statement at the last Canadian Cardiovascular the Congress, symposium in Quebec City. I'm going to remove my hat as a university professor and wear my hat as a father now. I don't accept what's going on in Canada. I mean, I use very strong words to describe right. what we're doing with our kids. You know, I said that our kids are prisoners of the sedentary lifestyle that we impose in schools. And I really mean this. And this was not meant to be an attack to, teachers who are doing what they can with, mm-hmm. The means that they are given. But, the level of fitness of our children in school has decreased substantially over the last 40 years. Our kids cannot run anymore. They don't play out enough. They are not physically active. And we need to turn that around. And to me, the simplest thing, this is a no-brainer. You know, if our kids are playing out vigorously every day, their fitness is going to increase, and you're going to create an energy buffer. Yeah, we're not going to, eliminate completely the toxic food environment, within weeks. But if we transform their sedentary daily lifestyle in school into a physically active lifestyle, clearly, this is going to help out. And we know that physical activity and exercise, even if adults or children don't lose weight, you improve their fit rate, their fitness. So you're going to tremendously improve their health, their cardiovascular and metabolic health, irrespective of whether or not they lose weight.
What are some of the factors that you believe have contributed to this reduction in activity in the schools? And frankly, we see kids that they play hockey, they do other stuff, but that seems to be a minority of children as opposed to the vast majority who now have their video games, have televisions, and they really don't participate on bright sunny days. They're inside playing their games.
Yeah, it's a reality. I very often I talk about that with my international colleagues all over the world. 40 years ago, as kids, we were out there with our bikes and playing out. We were simply playing out. Sometimes it was not structured, formal at all, but we were always out. Going in to eat was, oh my goodness, we have to eat, and the shorter the better, because we just couldn't wait to go back out there to play with our friends. Now, our kids are sedentary in school, then the best babysitter there is are the video games or the TV or the computer at home, while the kids lock themselves in the house for security reasons, because, we're worried about the safety of our children. So if it's not safe anymore for our kids to play out, or if we have the perception that it's not safe, we really have a problem. So, again, don't get me wrong, we are not going to be able to fix that within days. So for me, the simplest solution is to make sure that every day at school, under proper supervision, our kids are playing out, supervised, safely, that they can burn calories every day, and it's fun. And then, obviously, you need to, address the other determinants, of course. But we have to start somewhere.
And I guess also with regards to the foods that are sold at the schools, especially in the cafeterias, to be able to provide foods that are a little bit more healthful for them as opposed to calorie-dense fried foods.
Yes, of course. But this has to be accompanied by education. Yes. It's interesting in the United States, in New York, for instance, they did a huge in some schools. They have transformed the cafeterias of many, many schools in New York, offering now healthy choices, but the kids didn't get any nutrition education, so they still stuck, to the food of poor nutritional value, because this is what they have been, eating all their life. So this has to be accompanied also to be successful. By kids have to taste, various things and enjoy, variety, but you have to learn that, you have to experience that.
Well, it was interesting because it was Dr. Brian Wansink, who's the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University, also did an interesting study on schools and how the foods were actually presented. In this case, instead of calling something vegetable juice, as an example, they would call it a super vegetable smoothie.
And what they, I like that.
And funny enough is that the kids bought more of this particular drink because of the way it was named, as opposed to the boring vegetable juice.
Yeah, very interesting.
So, and again, you're right in that it is, there's education, there's perception, there's understanding what children are attracted to, and using that to help them as opposed to fighting against it.
Yeah. Very interesting.
I wanted to turn to weight loss and the huge billion-dollar industry that has developed with regards to weight loss programs and weight loss products and weight loss medications and bariatric surgery. And I wanted to ask you, what is the, and look at these individually, and what is the role for weight loss medication? Is there a role for it in clinical practice?
Oh, there is, but the rationale should be the same as the medical management of serious conditions like hypertension, like dyslipidemia and diabetes. And the problem with obesity is that it's such a poorly defined condition that anyone, you know, with a body mass index of 30 kilogram meter square and above is defined as obese. So if you use an index of relative weight to define what is obesity, you're going to end up with a mixed bag of healthy individuals that are very sick. So you have to go beyond that. And this has really been our point. I mean, I would completely disagree with the use of a quote-unquote pharmacological agent, mm-hmm. a weight loss drug, to just lose weight, to induce weight loss as an end per se, you know, without the ultimate objective of improving health and quality of life of patients that have not been successful in you know, losing this bad abdominal fat. It's the same thing with hypertension, you know.
Right.
If you lower your salt intake, if you eat better, maybe you don't need a drug to lower blood pressure. But if you don't succeed, blood pressure is such a powerful risk factor for cardiovascular disease that you must use a drug. It should be the same principle for pharmacotherapy of obesity.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be a patient asking a doctor, put me on this weight loss drug, you know, I've heard about it. No, it should be a medical decision. Let's see, first of all, if your form of overweight or obesity causes prejudice to your health.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been playing also to reshape, you know, the clinical environment so that we provide supports to those patients who want to lose some of their bad abdominal fat, you know, reshaping their nutritional habits, physical activity habits. Physicians get no training in med school to do that. They don't have the time to do that. And if we want to be serious about prevention, we need to provide to those patients and their treating physician access, you know, to a dietitian and mm-hmm. an exercise physiologist to help. Because the science is telling us that if we want that to work, we need to provide assistance to those patients. So we really need to bring, I would say, obesity by defining it better in the major league of cardiovascular, modifiable cardiovascular disease risk factors. And again, if you use weight or weight loss, you're off.
Now, I believe you did a few studies, and I think it was in New England Journal of Medicine, where you talked about using dietitians and follow-up with people once a month to ensure education was provided, to see how they were doing, and how using a specialized team, as you mentioned, where you have exercise physiologists and dietitian, can make a difference in developing permanent lifestyle changes for the patient. Can you talk about these studies a little bit and what results you saw when you did this?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a simple a study. When we test a new drug to, and I'm on purpose, I'm not using weight loss drug, but mm-hmm. it's a drug targeting what we call the endocannabinoid system, because we found that there is a system in your body producing phospholipid derivatives associated with abdominal obesity and the related metabolic abnormalities. That's a fairly long story, but there is a drug under study actually that has been approved in some countries in Europe, not approved yet in Canada or in the United States, that target the endocannabinoid system. And we tested the capacity of this, the ability of this drug to induce loss of abdominal fat and to improve the risk factor profile of patients with lipids abnormalities and with abdominal obesity. But in the design of our trial, we had a group of patients who receive a placebo for 1 year, and all the patients, either they receive a placebo or the active drug,
mm-hmm.
had the opportunity to see a dietitian once a month. So very, very simple, seeing a dietitian once a month. And just seeing the dietitian once a month for 1 year was associated with a weight loss of 4 kilos and a drop in waist circumference in 5 centimeters. No drug at all. Obviously, with the drug, we did better.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just seeing a dietitian once a month was able to induce a weight loss and a loss of abdominal fat, which had been shown in 2 papers published in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier, that this could reduce your risk of developing diabetes if you are high-risk individuals by almost 60%. 60% reduction in the probability that you might eventually develop type 2 diabetes just by seeing a dietitian once a month. So now with the support of the Canadian Institute of Health Research, we're doing a study at the Heart Institute where we're specifically testing that monthly visit mm-hmm. to a dietitian, to which we add a monthly visit to a kinesiologist, an exercise physiologist. So that exercise physiologist does the same for, I would say, the physical activity aspect of the lifestyle of the patient as the dietitian would do for the rehabilitation, if I may say so,
right.
of the nutritional habit. So really, the monthly visit, the nutritionist works to reshape the nutritional habits, and the exercise physiologist does the same. It's not an exercise, a formal exercise program. Of course, they recommend exercise, but the idea is to create opportunities, make sure that the patient remembers that there are opportunity for more physical activity throughout the days. Well, we have preliminary results after 1 year. The results are remarkable. We get twice the amount of weight loss, twice the loss of abdominal fat that we had reported in our New England Journal of Medicine paper, where we only use, you know, the help of a dietitian. So take-home message, very simple. If primary care doctors could send those high-risk patients to a team of dietitians and exercise physiologists for half an hour, monthly visit, we could do a lot. And I mean, a program like this, we have estimated that it would cost per patient on a yearly basis about $1,000 Canadian. If you look at the cost of the complications associated with type 2 diabetes, and you know we have millions of type 2 diabetic patients in our country, that's not expensive at all to do prevention, you know.
No, some people it costs them $600-$700 a month just for their medications.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of any final comments, you've mentioned several messages. One is with regards to the dietitians and the exercise physiologists or kinesiologists, it's reinforcing the message every month to keep people on track. It's what I'm gathering from that particular model, but also getting a better understanding of what type of fat is more risky for our health, and what people can do to circumvent that and reduce their risk.
Yeah. So right now, the reality is we have new modifiable risk factors. Again, abdominal obesity and related abnormalities. BMI does not do a proper job to identify those individuals. We have to, physicians have to measure waistline. I call it a vital sign. It is as important as paying attention to whether the patient smokes, has hypertension, mm-hmm. and diabetes. And then what to do? Well, I think at the individual level, those that are at high risk because they are abdominally obese and at high risk of diabetes and heart disease, we need to provide them with support that would be reimbursed, because we would, at the end of the day, save a lot of money, because if we could, you know, reduce the risk of diabetes in those individuals by, let's say, 50%, just to make a round number, the economic impact in the country would be absolutely tremendous. And you think about it, just reducing the prevalence of type 2 diabetes by 50% in our country, that would be fantastic, obviously, for the quality of life of those patients, but also the burden on the healthcare system, the relief would be tremendous. So those are individuals that are high risk with abdominal obesity. Now, for children also, because we know this is the youngest age group in the Canadian population, is showing the fastest growth in terms of the prevalence of obesity. We really, really, really have to be extremely aggressive with preschool children, children in school, making sure that they are physically active every day, that they are educated about healthy eating, a fun way. You know, it has to be pleasant. It's fun. It could be a tremendous educational exercise. And then, but this will require, you have to envision that it's going to take years, decades. We need to reshape the urban environment in which we live so that we make sure that running a bike in the city is not a risk factor for traumatic death, you know,
right.
Because our cities are more are friendlier for cars than human being. But I think we can start right away. We should start actually today.
Well, Dr. DePere, as always, it's been wonderful having you on the show, and I'm assuming I'm going to be asking you again very soon to come on and discuss this issue, because it seems that people really do need to be reminded, and not only just reminded, but having a better understanding based on the evidence of why they need to change certain aspects in their lives, improving their lifestyles, and just by doing that, they can make a tremendous difference overall for their long-term health.
Absolutely, and it'll be a pleasure.
All the best.
Thank you. You too.